Welcome to The Dream Show. I'm Jane Therese Anderson, and this is episode 266. And I have a little surprise for you today. If you're a long-time fan of The Dream Show, you'll know that we usually have a guest on the show, bringing a dream for us to explore and interpret, and we generally spend around 50 to 60 minutes going deep into the dream, seeing how it relates to the dreamer's life, and identifying insights that help the dreamer move forward in wonderful ways. And in other episodes, I read from some of my many blogs and articles, bringing you dream interpretation tips, and I hope plenty of inspiration to explore your own dreams. And while many of you listen on the various podcast platforms, you know, Apple, Spotify, etc., you can listen to every single episode from our very first episode in early 2009 up to and including today's at my website at janetheresa.com. That's Theresa without an H. Anyway, the surprise. After nearly 14 years and 265 episodes of The Dream Show, we decided to do something a little different between now and late November 2023, when we will return to the guest format. So over the next 10 episodes, I'm narrating my most recent book, Bird of Paradise, subtitled Taming the Unconscious to Bring Your Dreams to Fruition, which was published in 2020. Now, you can buy the paperback and the digital version from all the usual places where you buy your books, but I decided to offer the audio version in installments through The Dream Show instead of placing it with Audible. Publishing the audio version through the podcast means that there is no fee for you, but if you'd like to express your appreciation and enjoyment, I'd like to encourage you to buy the paperback version for yourself or as a gift for a friend or two. Thank you. So today's episode, episode 266, Bird of Paradise Part 1, is one of the longer episodes. This is to get you off to a good start. Future episodes are of variable lengths as they're determined by the size of the chapters, and many are shorter than today's. So yes, you will have to wait 4 weeks between episodes, but remember, you can always buy the paperback or digital version from wherever you usually buy your books. I wrote the book hoping that readers would begin at the beginning and journey page by page all the way to the end, but you will find that each episode is also standalone. If you miss one or more episodes, you can listen to a later one and still get plenty from it. So what's it about? To quote from the back cover of the book, Birds of Paradise is an inspirational guide to finding your calling and navigating your life using dreams, mysteries, and alchemy. It's part whimsical memoir, part healing balm, and part alchemical guide, and it delivers my down-to-earth tools and techniques for decoding dreams and synchronicities, as well as my unique signature alchemy practices that enable you to flow and grow with life's challenges, paradoxes, and mysteries. So let's begin. Bird of Paradise, Taming the Unconscious to Bring Your Dreams to Fruition, Part 1. One morning, the flowers laid themselves at my feet. "Write about us," they seemed to say. I leaned in with sweet surrender and entered into the flow. Chapter 1, Garden of Dreams. This book that you have before you is part whimsical memoir, part healing balm, and part alchemical guide to navigating your human journey by observing some of the deeper mysteries of the human experience. It aims, in a larger sense, to be an inspiration to you, to be used in ways that will enrich your life. Bird of Paradise is made up of stories I've wanted to share for a long time. Stories whose time to be given a wider audience has now come. But they're not individual stories, and this is not one of those Dippin and Read books, although I know you'll be tempted to do just that. Accompany me from the beginning, where appropriately enough we begin with a story called The Seed and progress all the way through to Shavasana. I am a dream analyst and dream therapist whose work is largely based on my own research and practice of more than 30 years. As such, I have been privileged to spend much of my professional life engaged in exploring my clients' dreams and witnessing their breakthroughs as they quite magically bloom and grow in their amazing lives. When I haven't been working with clients, I've been writing about dreams and dreaming, speaking about dreams and dreaming in the media, training students to work with dreams, and at night, dreaming my own dreams. When I look back over my life so far, I see a path of dreams. I think of my early childhood, and there it is, my dream of snakes nesting at the foot of my bed. I think of being 6 or 7, and there it is, in full colour and vivid heart-pounding emotion, my dream of being a shepherd boy encountering a pack of wolves gazing down at me from a mountain ridge with ominous intensity. I think of being 9 or 10, and there it is, the plane flying at such a sharp incline that it flips over backwards and explodes in the sky. I think of being 13, and there it is once more, a dream of my grandfather, a couple of days after his death, riding a motorbike into my dream and casually asking me if there's anything I'd like to know before he rides off again. As a child, I was curious. Were these dreams a parallel reality? Did they offer glimpses into a more distant past and perhaps a past life? Or were they predictions of future accidents or glimpses into the spirit world? As a child, I was entranced by the magic of dreams and always welcomed the promise of the nightly adventures that sleep would bring, even the scary ones. As my dreams became increasingly surreal, I began to understand that they were rather more like energy pictures, depicting my emotions and interactions with the world. Yet they were also larger than life, as if they offered a glimpse of a bigger and deeper part of myself and the nature of life than I could grasp while awake. I can mark out my life in dreams as if turning the pages of a photo album. Most key events and turning points in my life were preceded or accompanied by vivid dreams, and I know the same will hold true in the years to come. It's not that my dreams predicted my future. Like all dreams, they connected or reconnected me with the deepest parts of my being. When I learned how to understand my dreams, I learned how to understand myself and my life, and how to use those insights to make powerful changes when that was what was called for. These are the blessings that dreams bestow. And since every one of us dreams about 5 dreams a night, whether or not we remember them, on a regular basis, they are universal gifts available to each and every one of us. To accept these gifts, we need to learn and practice the art and science of reading dreams and allow the insights they bring to bestow the blessings they hold. There's a certain magic that comes from spending so much of a life in dreams. Your eyes acclimate to seeing beyond the everyday, and you experience quite astounding synchronicities and mysterious goings-on. You witness a greater tapestry that's woven from the threads of yesterday, today, and tomorrow. Among the vignettes contained herein, you'll find tips and techniques to help you understand your dreams. That said, however, Dreams are not the main subject of this book. They are markers on the path, inspiring you to look and discover the big picture of your life's purpose. The entire book is a story strewn with flowers, trees, and birds that bloom, shelter, and sing a direction for the reader to follow. You will notice that most of the chapter titles refer to flowers. The book also contains a subtle through line, one I have gently nurtured to build your understanding of the mysteries of the psyche as you turn its pages. Read slowly, read quickly, read and pause, read and ponder, but stay with the flow page by page and begin at the very beginning. As this book wrote itself into being, I realised I had a cache of stories that had accumulated in various blogs I'd written over the years, so I gathered these together and wove them in. Most are slightly updated with the wisdom of hindsight or reworked to fit the style of this book. So if you're reading and thinking, I know this story from somewhere, well, now you know. As regards the book's title, there is such a creature as a bird of paradise, but that is not the bird of my story. My bird of paradise appears in several guises throughout these pages. You'll first meet him as Joey the Budgie in The Seed, and you'll last meet her, yes her, in this book as a constellation of light in the epilogue. In the pages in between, you'll also encounter the Bird of Paradise flower and the Bird of Paradise yoga pose. Once you finish reading, I imagine that the Bird of Paradise will cross your path in many forms, shedding a feather here and there, or a petal or two, or challenging you to yoga extend your limbs to fully embody her true nature. Or you would simply hear her calling to you in what may be some other mysterious, enigmatic way. So let's begin. Don't think too hard, and certainly don't analyse as you go. Just immerse yourself in and read. Next chapter, The Seed. Miracles happen. Who would have thought? One Easter, when I was about 6, my dad was shaving at the kitchen sink. He put down his razor and peered through the window. "Is that a budgie perched on our washing line?" he asked. We tiptoed into the garden to investigate, hoping the bird wouldn't fly away. In England, where I was born and lived as a young child, budgies don't live in the wild. Essentially a parakeet, they frequently live in cages, one or two per tiny cage parked in the living room. Here they nod, peck at their reflections in teensy play mirrors, and talk, broken records of their masters' voices, cocking their heads from side to side as they study you. I knew this because my granny had a budgie. "He must have escaped," Dad pronounced. "Look, he's got a big lump on his head. Maybe he flew into a wall, got knocked out and forgot his way home." "Hello, Joey," said the budgie, opening and then resettling his wings. Dad offered a finger as a perch and Joey climbed on it. We made him a temporary cage. It was a cardboard box with a cellophane front for a window, and we poked pinholes in the cellophane so Joey could breathe. "We can't keep him," said Dad, as he wrote some big words spelled out in capital letters on a plain postcard. "Found, budgie, says his name is Joey." The local newsagent put the card in his window. But no one claimed Joey. In school, a little while later, I waited in the spelling line at my teacher's desk, piece of paper in hand, to ask how to spell budgie, so I could write the story in the daily journal that we each had to keep. The teacher told me that budgie was short for budgerigar, and that budgerigars lived in the wild in Australia. Now, that really excited me because as a much younger child, I had dug a hole in our back garden with an old dessert spoon, hoping to dig through the middle of the earth and come out on the other side in Australia. I had a globe in my bedroom and I had seen Australia hanging upside down on the bottom of it. So as a result, I was very curious about it. In any event, eventually Dad bought Joey a cage with a perch, a mirror, a piece of cuttlefish to sharpen his beak, and all the other accessories an English pet budgie requires. The bump on his head fell off one day, and we laughed ourselves to tears, for it was nothing but seed shuck that had somehow gotten trapped under his crown feathers. Joey lived in his cage in the corner of the room for many years, speaking his lines every day, instructed and rehearsed by Dad. "Hello, Joey. Jane's a good girl. 75,000. This last was the amount of money Dad hoped to win on the British football pools. His verbal repertoire was recorded on a long piece of paper tucked into the space between his sand tray and the bottom of the cage. After a few years, he was saying so many different things that we had to turn the paper over so we could write more on the other side. A budgie was about as exotic as birds got in our neighbourhood. I had seen pictures of kingfishers with bright blue chests, and I had heard that budgies were small fry, so to speak, compared to parrots. But I didn't personally know anyone who had a caged parrot, and I'd certainly never met anyone who had found a wild budgie in their own back garden. Australia dropped off my agenda shortly thereafter because I got tired of digging with my spoon. Or was it because I was reprimanded for making a big hole in the middle of the lawn? I had no wish to live in Australia. And when my first husband, Douglas, and I did come here for a 3-year stint in 1984, I looked forward to returning home at the end of our stay. Yet here I am now, all these years later, living in this magical place. We never did return to England to live. After nearly 7 years living in a country town and our divorce, I moved to Sydney before remarrying and then settling in Brisbane for some 24 years. This was a place where, even in the heart of the city, parrots, lorikeets, rosellas, and other colourful parrot-like birds are a common sight. They're background music to the business of daily living, especially and magnificently when rain blesses the subtropical trees with blossoms, pollen, fruits, and seeds. I think I've only seen a budgerigar once in the wild here, but whenever I bask in the sight of parrots flitting among the trees or waking me from dreams with their dawn chorus, I remember Joey and digging my hole to Australia with that old dessert spoon. Who would have thought it? Nothing is impossible. When you dream big and take your first steps, even with an old dessert spoon, magic can happen. And here's a greater thought to keep your heart in the right place throughout. Your everyday reality may be someone else's dream. My story gets better, and here's its punchline. After I had committed to opening this book with this story, a handwritten note was delivered to the letterbox in our front garden here in Australia. You could have knocked me down with a cliched feather, for posting notes about lost budgies around the neighbourhood is not something that happens anymore. I hadn't even realised that people still kept budgies. The note said, and there's a photo of it in the book, "Lost budgie found in Milton Paddington area at Isaac Street, Wednesday, May the 11th. If you've lost a budgie, send its description by text to," and there's the cell phone number, "to see if it's yours." That was amazing. Life had come full circle, at least in the budgie department. This sign from the universe was encouragement that I was squarely on my path and that magical creative work, which you now hold in your hands, was about to unfold. Next chapter, Subtropical Blossoms. Grevillea banksii. I heard the call, and I'm here to tell the tale. The Tale of Two Feathers. The message that I should write this book was reinforced by The Tale of Two Feathers. In early 2015, when I had begun the process of merging my websites into a more streamlined and contemporary site, I engaged a branding stylist and a web designer to use their exquisite arts to communicate mine. My art comprised of the work that I do with my clients in their dreams. The arts of the branding stylist and web designer include the design of symbols, images, graphics, and web architectural technology to communicate my work in visuals. I received the gift of seeing my art interpreted and portrayed through their eyes, which in turn helped me recognize the subtleties of my offerings. At the same time, I was doing some yoga breath work with a pranayama yoga specialist to liberate a persistent cough that was eager to be heard. I engage in the practice of yoga several times a week. In just one session, he did his magic, restoring my ability to breathe deeply without spluttering, and in parallel, freeing my ability to flow more fully with my work. I was open and ready for the next stage, whatever that would be. The next day, I walked the few hundred meters to the yoga studio, swung my yoga mat from my back, and unrolled it onto the floor. Out popped a beautiful, iridescent, green feather. It was a lorikeet feather, and it must have fallen from the sky into my tightly rolled mat during that very short walk. If so, this was quite a feat, and it sent a little shock up my spine. 2 days later, I took a t-shirt off the hook on the back of our bedroom door, and as I slipped it on, I saw something silvery glinting on one of the shoulders. It was an earring, a silver feather hanging on a silver dream catcher. Whose earring was this? And how had it ended up hooked onto my t-shirt, a shirt I'd worn briefly a couple of times before hanging it on the hook a few days before? As it turned out, the earring belonged to my daughter-in-law, Natalie, who was staying with us at the time. "Where did you find that?" she asked. "I haven't seen it for 4 months." Right away, I noticed the connection between the feather and writing, a quill, and the fact that I am myself a dream catcher, being the dream analyst that I am. Connecting the dots, did this indicate that I was meant to start writing a new book in my capacity as a dream analyst? I was beginning to think it did. On my office wall is a framed photo of a baby bird stretching and feeling its wings, with a quote from my book Dream Alchemy, which was later updated and published as the Dream Handbook, beneath. It reads, "The world cannot benefit from your talents unless you unfold your wings." I've noticed that people shed a tear or two when they look at that, so I know it's a powerful statement. Acknowledging the nudge that the photo provided, I unfolded my own wings. I slipped the green feather and the silver feathery dreamcatcher earring into the photo's frame to seal my intention and dipped my quill into ink to write the book that you're now reading. Obviously, Joey's English seed had found its home, sprouted, taken root, transformed, and blossomed. In the process, I had learned the language that feathers speak. So when that feather fell onto my yoga mat, it certainly got my attention, and I was able to understand what it meant. Who would have thought? Magic can happen. I heard the call, and I'm here to tell the tale. Dream time, tea time. To further demonstrate how the dreaming life may inform and catalyse the creative life, I want to share with you a dream I had when I was contemplating writing my fifth book. This one, Bird of Paradise, is my seventh book. The dream was in the mid-2000s. It all started with a cup of tea. Well, that was the idea anyway. I was trying to wake myself up to make a cup of tea to bring back to bed, but my dreamy mind was brewing something a little more exotic than mundane black breakfast tea. This was the dream. In the dream time, I paddled down the hall in my dressing gown, boiled the kettle, opened the blinds, and pondered the dewy garden. Everything was exactly as it should have been on a normal Wednesday morning. I opened the fridge to get the milk, and my heart missed a beat. A rainbow-coloured bird was flitting around inside, full of life and warmth, despite the icy interior of the over-frosted fridge. "Oh, poor little thing, did you get trapped in the fridge?" I twittered, standing back to open the door wide so that he could fly out. But he didn't fly out, and so I looked more closely. There were now three rainbow-coloured birds in the fridge, a trio of dawn chorus heralding sunshine and awakenings after a long, cold night. I knew that my husband, Michael, was still asleep in bed, and I had wanted to wake him gently with the morning tea, but this couldn't keep. "Michael!" I called down the hall. "Sorry to wake you up, but this is too good to miss. Come and have a look." By the time he got to the kitchen, the fridge was pumping with an exotic exuberance of wildlife. Two very large goldfish, swimming in the water at the bottom of the fridge, poked their faces out and surveyed us cheekily. I laughed and gently nudged them back into the menagerie theatre, two characters from a story who were yet to play their part in the whole. "Good feng shui," I noted to Michael. "Did you see the size of those goldfish? Talk about abundance." "Look closely," Michael whispered in awe. "The snakes are the sibilants. The other animals are the vowels and consonants, the commas, full stops, exclamation marks, paragraphs, chapters, adjectives, metaphors, all the parts that together tell a story." "Sibilance," I thought to myself in the dream, "that's the hiss, isn't it? Like the lisp I didn't know I had until a few years ago when a voice coach told me she'd give me some exercises to cure my lisp." Lazily, I put the exercises to one side along with a few escaped S's and decided my voice was simply and stunningly unique as it was. At this point, I woke up, still in bed. The cold trip down to the hall to make the tea was still ahead of me. I began to think about my dream, and it was only a matter of minutes before I was asleep again, dreaming another dream. Soon I was sitting on a kitchen bench in my grandmother's house, boiling water in the kettle to make a cup of tea, pondering the dewy English garden through the window. The house had been renovated and hugely extended over the decades since my grandmother's death, but the wonderful, nurturing smells of her kitchen remained. Michael sat beside me, warming the teapot, while I plunged my hand into a tall, white ceramic jar of mixed dried herbs, leaves, fruits, and berries. "My grandmother used to collect these from her garden," I explained to Michael. "They have dried into this unique exotic tea over the years." As I reverently scattered a few handful into the teapot, hundreds of rainbow-coloured birds flew in and around the two old apple trees in the back garden. There was an explosive fruition of birdsong as the aroma of the ancient herbal tea was released by the first drops of newly boiled water. Waking up, yet again laying tealess in bed, Michael still asleep and the long walk down the hall to the kitchen still ahead of me, I pondered my dreams. Dream interpretation aficionados should be jumping up and down by now, excited by the dream's many clues. For example, there's wordplay in sibilant that sounds in part like sibyl. A sibyl is an ancient seer, a mind reader, perhaps even a dream analyst, especially one who sometimes experiences precognitive dreams. The snakes, that the dream Michael pointed out with the sibilance, the hiss makers in my dream, are an ancient symbol of dream healing and a personal totem of mine. Both dreams were about releasing a vibrant, multi-sensual energy that had been slowly brewing, maturing towards its moment of harvest. The first dream showed the coming together of elements that had been put on ice, frozen and stored, as if waiting for all the right elements to be brought into life together at just the right time. The second dream showed the fusion of the elements that had been dried, the herbs, leaves, fruits and berries. These needed to be arranged in the right combination, together with the element of time. All of these elements clearly referenced the material that would comprise my fifth book. Dream Alchemy, later released as the Dream Handbook. Like any creative person, I have certainly put a number of creative ideas into storage over the years, sometimes because too many projects spoiled the broth, and sometimes because I knew that some of the elements were missing. This had been the case with my fifth book as well. What was the meaning of these dreams overall? Based on the latter dream, I realised that my unconscious mind had finished brewing something, and it was time for me to awaken and express that something in a new book. The clues in my dream were plentiful enough to point me in the right direction, but being a dream alchemist, I decided on my course of action, and it was to live and feel like this. I am living, breathing and feeling the wonderfully orchestrated energy of my fridge menagerie. Only it's no longer confined to the fridge. It's within me, yet seeping through my pores, warm-bloodedly and passionately singing itself into waking life fruition. By feeling into this, I was engaging with the language of my dream to awaken the dawn chorus. I walked down the hall to the kitchen to make a cup of black tea. But it was no longer just a cup of black tea, was it? The next chapter, Bird of Paradise, Strelitzia reginae, a bright orange origami work of art. Origami. A bright orange origami work of art caught my eye. Itself caught up in a stand of tall lilies and ornamental grasses bordering the entrance to the townhouse complex where I would write my first book, Sleep on It, which was published by HarperCollins in 1994. Who folded it? And how had it gotten here? Had a breeze whipped it out of its maker's hands? Or was it set free into the winds with intention, an intricately folded, delicate paper kite, no strings attached? The bright orange reminded me of the robe of a Buddhist monk. Looking closer, I realised it wasn't paper origami. It was a flower, asymmetrical, oddly beautiful, attached to a stem and rooted firmly in the earth. I was new to subtropical Queensland where we lived then, and this was my first encounter with a bird of paradise. Today, when I think of bird of paradise, I think of the eponymous yoga pose where you begin with your feet on the ground and your arms bound around one leg. Then you stand up, drawing the bound leg up, and then standing tall, straighten that leg and point your toe, opening out like a tree. Holding this pose, I imagine a flower, a lotus, a rose, or is it a bird perched on my skyward pointing toe? Sometimes the pose is fluid and easy. Sometimes it's clunky. Sometimes there's too much wobble to get it happening at all. The best instruction I've ever heard is to just do it quickly without thinking. And that does indeed do the trick. Just go from both feet on the floor to end point before thinking gets in the way. I doubt the bird of paradise grows that way. Surely it grows as other flowers do, slowly, slowly, all in perfect time. Some of my books have been written slowly, slowly. Some have been just do it quickly jobs, tumbling out onto the page, words folding upon words in origami shapes as my typing fingers try to catch them as fast as they appear. The released birds, fish and animals from my dream fridge, as relayed in Dreamtime Tea Time, together with the colourfully vibrant words released from my grandmother's long brewed tea, arrange themselves into two more books, my fifth and sixth paperbacks, and then poured their energies into the blog, which I began in 2009. Yet, slowly, slowly, this book you are now reading was brewing, and as I begin to commit to writing it, I was called to the stage once more. The next chapter, and this is the last one for this episode, is Honeysuckle, Lonnie Sierra. One morning the flowers laid themselves at my feet. Write about us, they seemed to say. I leaned in with sweet surrender and entered into the flow. It can't be that hard. The alchemists of old spent years working out how to transform base metal into pure gold. I, of the modern dream alchemist variety, spent 4 weeks working out how to transform a ripped, mouldy lampshade into something beautiful enough to stand in the corner of my friend's room and shine a golden light. Now, this may be something you know how to do, but all I had was a vision and the feeling that once I got the lampshade frame home, that I had taken on a task way beyond my capability. It was a standard lamp, but not your average standard shape. It was a vintage 1920s, I guess, and had a dome shape with the scalloped edges and a fringe. You choose the fabric and fringe, I told my friend, and I'll redo the shade for you. It can't be that hard. I should watch the words I speak. It can't be that hard instantly impresses the word hard. Either I knew it would be hard, or it became hard because I spoke the word. And then there were those other words. I'll redo the shade for you. Perhaps I should have watched those too, I thought, as the challenge lay in pieces before me, seemingly impossible. I could have said, I'll find someone to redo it for you. Nonetheless, my vision was simple. The old fabric had been applied in two halves. So all I had to do was cut two halves, stretch them over the frame, join them up, and sew on a fringe. I soon discovered that the fabric didn't give that way, and the old fabric had been glued, not sewn. Using glue for a complete beginner in this lampshade restoration business was not a good plan. I needed to be able to undo my mistakes. I cut smaller templates that failed. I googled how to cover a lampshade and learned that for this particular shape, it was best to get a professional to do the job. I contemplated giving up, sending it to a professional, or just buying a replacement. But then a strange thing happened. Each time I contemplated giving up, and there were many times, a solution presented itself. Sometimes the solution was instantaneous, and what had just seemed impossible was suddenly a fait accompli. Sometimes the solution appeared as soon as I opened my eyes in the morning, presented by what had been a puzzle-solving dream. I leapfrogged through the work, alternately making progress with the seemingly impossible bit, hitting another snag, contemplating giving up, then receiving a magical solution and carrying out the next step. All of this seemed familiar, and it took me back to several times in my life when I'd felt overwhelmed by challenges far larger than covering a lampshade. These were times when I'd felt like giving up, but then solutions suddenly appeared. I realised all those past challenges rewarded me with personal and spiritual insight. Looking back, I see they opened doors, and led to places that would otherwise have remained closed to me. The more I thought about this, the more I realised that in those past challenges and in the making of this lampshade, I had never actually given up. Instead, I had let go. I released the old way or vision and opened to seeing a new way. I surrendered. And when you surrender, miracles happen, even little ones. Finally, over the Easter weekend, I finished the lampshade and delivered it to my friend. As the alchemists of old knew, it's not about whether base metal can be turned into gold, and given the present state of technology, it can't. It's about what you learn about yourself, personally and spiritually, along the way. It's the old, the journey is more important than the destination thing. Life is such a journey, and the path often is the destination. My challenge had been infinitely smaller and entirely due to my status as a complete novice, but it presented me with a perfect reminder of the value of surrender and trust. It may be my first and last lampshade reconstruction exercise, but I'm sure my big mouth will present me with other similar challenges from time to time. I hope the next time I say, it's easy, rather than, it can't be hard. But if I forget to choose my words carefully, I will remember to surrender to life's alchemy and trust that the universe will find a way to help me accomplish it with success. All the world's a stage. I dreamed I was to play a classical orchestral piece on a keyboard. It was to be a solo performance. The auditorium was packed. The audience looked discerning. An anticipatory silence descended, and all eyes were on me, seated at the keyboard at the very centre of the room. Not only had I not studied or practiced the piece, but I'm not a musician. I might have been able to play Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star with one finger, but then again, maybe not. I wondered what to do. I thought I was alone in this, but to my surprise, the conductor came into the room, sat opposite me across the keyboard, and held me in her mesmerizing gaze. I woke up before playing a note, although now I knew what to do. I woke up feeling confident and energised. I was ready to begin, to place my fingers on my laptop keyboard to orchestrate words into being. My dream reflected the decision I had just made about writing this book and the last throes of inner conflict about a change of writing approach and style. My previous books were all planned in detail before I began writing them. I named chapters, summarised the intended content chapter by chapter, created a template for each chapter, decided upon a style, and specified the path that I would take to guide readers through a process to get my message across. There was rationality in the structure, a solid plan. I was so prepared for each book that I even knew how long it would take me to write each one. My writing days were carefully mapped out. X number of writing days at Y number of words equals first draft completed by Z date. And that worked for each of the 6 paperback books I've written. Safe within that structure, the actual words I chose were free to find their own expression, to surprise me with new twists, insights, metaphors, to write their own examples and to make me smile. So I haven't prepared for this book you're reading now in my usual classical way. I haven't prepared a structure, marked out days in my diary, plotted the path or even the message. Instead, I feel the music. My dream reminded me that some part of me knows how to conduct the flow, to hold my attention in the mesmerised moment. All I need to do is lean into the keyboard and let the magic unfold. That much I understood at the end of my dream. Later that morning, I realized that some part of me was also the musical keyboard in the dream. I was the instrument or channel for the music, no doubt conducted by my mesmerized in-the-moment intuitive self, free to break free from a pre-planned logical structure. Sticking with the metaphor, this may sound like I'm making a big deal about myself and my abilities, but in dream analysis, it's helpful to look at everything as well as everyone in the dream as representing something about the dreamer. In short, if I get stuck while I'm writing, I will imagine being the music. This is a form of dream alchemy, moving into a potent dream symbol, giving it and yourself more life. Now, dear discerning audience, there are no big promises here. I may write something wonderful, something inspirational, something profound, or I may write something more akin to a one-fingered rendition of Twinkle Twinkle Little Star. In any event, whatever it is, I will enjoy the process, and I hope you will too. The night before this dream, I dreamed I was on stage performing in a Shakespearean play. Everyone else knew their lines. I didn't. I hadn't prepared. But I got by. As I whispered to one of the other actors, "It's okay, I don't know the lines, but I know the general gist." Much to the other actors' amusement, I reframed Shakespeare's beautiful poetry to fit the theme, and even had the audience laughing at one point at my Shakespearean puns. I would certainly have been booed off the stage in waking life, but as a precursor to my keyboard dream, it rather fits the bill, don't you think? So there was the dream, then some time spent moving house, contemplating some necessary projects, clearing the space, and then suddenly, one morning, the flowers that you will read about in the following chapters laid themselves at my feet. "Write about us," they seemed to say. I sat down at the keyboard, listened, and entered the flow. And that's where I'm stopping the reading for the moment. So thank you for listening to part one of Bird of Paradise. The next instalment, part two, will be released as episode 267, which is due out on the 23rd of March 2023, if you're listening to this in real time. Now remember, you can buy the paperback or digital version wherever you usually buy your books, or look under books on the menu on my website at janeteresa.com. That's Jane Teresa without an H. JaneTeresa.com is also where you can go to discover my other books and courses, as well as to consult me privately. And JaneTeresa.com is also where you can go to listen back through all previous episodes of The Dream Show. If you're keen to listen to guests exploring their dreams with me, go back to episode 265 and work back from there. Thank you for listening to yet another episode of The Dream Show. I'm Jane Teresa Anderson.